Happy New Year, Forsling.
Happy New Year, Forslings. And that's important. Forslings is a word used by Zappa in his script Hutchintoot, I think in 1972. He had the extraterrestrial invaders of the Earth, or the anti-invaders, I can't remember, but they were called Forslings, and Roxy has not been able to let go of the term. She addresses everybody as a Forsling, has not stopped since then.
As somebody engaging your force field.
Right, right. You have your own. It's Zappa anticipating Iandam. So I just want to say that we did a whole bunch of new information on the Loire Valley because Roxy started looking out monster movies in the Zappa mode, and that led to the Chambord Castle and all this new stuff. Did you hear what we broadcast an hour or two ago, Roxy, from Ion? Or were you still sleeping?
Yes, I was sleeping.
Okay.
I woke up around 1, and I said, oh, it's 1. I woke up around 1, and I said, oh, it's 1. I sleep a little more.
Right.
And then I woke up again. No.
Right. Okay, well, you're here for this, so... You have a lot of stuff you want to start off, and I will take a cough drop and listen to your beginning points of Zappa Comensis. How do you say his name? Comensis?
John Amos Comenius.
Comenius. Subgenius Comenius. Okay.
Well, in Czech, I think they say Komensky. In German, they use the Latin name as they would call him then Comenius, not Komensky.
Okay. And they're both Slav? The Czechs and the Germans are both Slavs?
No, the Germans are Aryan.
Aryan. So that's why you get the SKY in the Slavs. And not in the literate Germans. They still got some Latin part of their German culture. Okay, so did you want to talk about that first, Comenius?
Well, this...
You want me to play a bit of the video on him?
Not really.
He sent to YouTube. Okay, all right, go ahead then.
No, the YouTube is a film with the whole view of Comenius just to get the basics. Cool.
Right, so what did he do?
Well, he's supposed to be the first pedagogue, and he wrote the first textbook. And
for school,
Yes, the Gutenberg Galaxy was not an environment yet.
Yeah.
And because not many people were educated, not many people knew how to read. And during this space, we had been doing different types of metanoias and to overlay and understand how the vortices and Zappa, which is our example, work. And we have mentioned many times that Zappa was also a big pedagogue, and all of the artists that and scientists that we call vorticists, in a way, are, I would say, teaching people, but in a very non-conventional way. Like Ion said, we're not here to help. We are just presenting the information for people to engage. And I think that's what all vortices do. They do these metanoias and then go out to explore and motivate the forcelings to do their own explorations and be aware of the vortex, make their own pattern recognition, and educate their perception, and they do these I think there are many similarities in what Luis, Joyce, Mathieu, and you do, and Zappa, in this pedagogic enterprise. But
and ION. You see, ION is a completing the vortices.
Yeah, actually, I would say in a way, ION is using the same compositional tools that Zappa defined all these concepts like this, synchrony, the everything, everywhere, all the time, for no reason at all. And how he's putting somehow himself from the Genesis, from the Emerald Tablets, the Bible, Nostradamus, Joyce, in McLuhan, in Zappa, in Lewis, in your work. It's like there are subjects that come and come and come and come again and again and again and again in many different formats. And it's like, okay, if you don't get it, here's once more. And it's all about this genesis of man from the fall to the completion. But of course, until now, all this odyssey was not finished. Is this meme of the trip of going back to the golden age, to the Garden of Eden, to the Tree of Life, and I was commenting to you that McLuhan said we put on these technologies, and that is actually what Genesis is all about, how the technologies are created, and we put on all these technologies like clothes. And for me, the metaphor of Adam in the Garden of Eden naked is the ascended that doesn't need to put on any technologies. So this nakedness is when we don't need these extensions anymore, because we are completed and reset and the blood has changed. And we don't need these external tools. And so doing this metanoia of pedagogy, I went back to Amos Comenius, because I see many of the ideas that McLuhan was talking about, like how you are not taught only by school, but actually by your whole environment, was something that Comenius was saying too. And it's very interesting because he said he wanted to make, in a way, like a logical system to educate the children, but he was worried about their nutrition and their education. And he had a classification of the senses that included the sensus communis, which is somehow this interaction between all the senses. He said the mother of all senses is the touch. So the mother of invasion is tactility. And he also considered fantasy and memory, which now we consider cognition. He considered fantasy and memory also like senses. And it's very interesting that he talks about the sensus communis, because as we said before, the Gutenberg galaxy was not an environment, and somehow these effects that came with the printing press were not yet so affecting all the population in a way. I suppose many people were still somehow more acoustic than visual. So would you like to say something?
No, that's very good what you said so far. And so he uses the term sensus communis.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty amazing because that's a major term.
On his first textbook, which is called Orbis Pictus, so it's, they translate it as The World Illustrated. I think it was printed in... Let me check before I say something which is not true. In 1658, he starts from the senses, and he divided the senses in the inner and the outer senses. And he thought we perceive the outer kingdom, what we call the outer kingdom, with the perception, but they still believed in this separation in body and soul. And the other type of mystery landscape we will then perceive with the soul. And I think that's an idea that still dominates.
That dominates. That's the title of Eric McClune's new book.
Most people still believe in the physical body and the soul, but you came to say, no, it's not only this division of body-soul. Actually these different bodies being created with each technology, and then the last expansion is the non-physical.
Yeah, no, that's well said. The Eric McClune's new book is called Sensus Communis, Synesthesia and the Soul. And McLuhan, he retrieved the term sensus communis in 1950s and 60s, and nobody was using it for a while. And you're saying that Comenius would be the first educator, the first pedagogue to use that term in the print
world.
Yes,
the term comes from Aristotle, but he was trying to define this interaction between all the senses. And he will he thought this is somehow in the fourth part of the head, and they perceive the things from the, like, it makes a synthesis of the outer kingdom, mixing the information of all the senses.
Right. And the inner kingdom is the soul?
I have to study in deep all his different writings, because I think he was not that clear sometimes. But the main idea he had is that there is like the nature, the first nature, the perfect nature created by God, and the second nature, he didn't call it like that, it's like I'm using the McLuhan terms, the second nature that was the nature modified by humans. And he thought children had to be educated so that this modification of the perfection, of the divine perfection, of the creation, is not destruction, but something worth of the divine, so that we should be aware that we have this power of changing the first nature and do something that is at that level, not destroy the perfection created by God, which is actually, Ian says, all, both the first nature and the second nature are all God, man made. But he still thought there was this divine creation and the man modification of the creation. And he always used the metaphor of the garden, that we should try to recreate the perfection of the Garden of Eden, even if we modify the first nature. And for example, here in Brixdorf, he's a very important character, because the Protestants that were accepted by the king are all like fans of Comenius for different reasons. Comenius had to escape because he was a Protestant, and he spent many years escaping, living in trees, and sometimes he would be accepted by some king, but he was escaping most of his life, and he lost his library, I think, twice, all his children, and I think he married also twice, and his family died, because that was the time of the Black Plague, after the religion wars. All his children died, but not once, twice. So he had a very hard life. But still he was a big idealist. He had the idea of the Pansophia, that someday there will be this new world order, but he will call it different, where all men are united, and he thought education should be for everybody all the time. And it's not only about going to school, but the children should engage in different types of exploration of their environment, with art and different medias, and going to the places where people work and see how they work and understand how the first nature, the divine nature created by God, and the things that are altering this first nature work.
So he advocated people to go to the factories and see.
Well, there were no factories at the time. There were like
guilds,
hand workers, and that's in the 17th century. Yeah, he said children should go in excursions and engage in plays, in theater. He called the world the labyrinth of the world. He said his children should go explore this labyrinth.
And that included going to work sites. Because what McLuhan advocated in his book, City's Classroom. So it's the same thing.
Yes. That's why I see many similarities in what he's saying. McLuhan. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been many studies about his some sort of comparisons of the ideas of John Amos Comenius, the first pedagogue, and McLuhan, because they were actually saying education is not only the formal school, that until Comenius was in the convents for monks or aristocrats. And actually his ideas influenced a lot of kings, and they created the first public schools. And he had like a slogan, everything for everybody, all the time. Sounds a little like...
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Like everybody should be able to learn everything all the time. Because it's not only about going to school, but in your whole environment. And he will really inspire the children to go out and explore and learn by themselves. And I think this autodidactic enterprise is something that most of the vorticists
yes
promote. Yes, yeah. It's not only about going to an institution and learn by memory and vomit everything you learn, but it's more about being aware of your environment and do your own exploration.
Yeah, now LaRouche wanted everybody to redo, the kids, redo all the major experiments, learn and be the scientists, do what Socrates did, do what Lavoisier did. All these different people made major experiments through history. That's what an education is. The kids redo them. They act out the discovery. Now, Zappa has the same program. He's telling the kids to go to school. He's trying to get them to use a broader environment and understand what the world they live in, the media that's massaging them. Right? Zappa is
right, and he also said it's important not to lose the connection between what he called the divine and the heart, because he thought it was the heart. What Dion says is
right,
all the hypothalamus. Because he saw we were going to become maybe like robots
robots.
Yeah, people. For example, he was accused of heresy, although the Jesuits started to use his ideas and his books for teaching. He was persecuted by the church. And in several occasions, for example, in France, and also the Jesuits made some offers for communions to repent and be a Christian again, because he was a Protestant and work with the Vatican or with the church.
Right.
But he refused.
And that was a serious refusal. He had to hide.
Yes. Yes, because even some of the Protestant kings will work with him for a time, but they didn't want to have too much trouble with the Vatican. And then, or they were themselves in civil wars. So he had to go again somewhere else. And at the end, he died in the Netherlands. But he was...
What year? What was happening when he died? What year was that?
I don't remember dates.
I can look it up.
Just wiki him.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, Newton is happening in 1666, 1670, so he's part of Newton's era, but he might be older than Newton.
Yes, and his first textbook goes from the man from the senses to the stars, and he thinks he then has the whole knowledge in this book.
What you're saying? You're saying that he wrote a book about the ground and then to the stars?
Yeah, the Orbis Pictus, which means the World Illustrated. So we already
right.
see how the visual is dominating with the book. Yeah, it goes from the perception. He defines that we have this, not only five senses, but he talks about the sensus communis. Memory and fantasy also as type of perception. And he puts everything I think he knows in this book, and like a small encyclopedia with many engravings with little numbers. So what he's talking about, he puts a small number and then you can see the illustration. And okay. It goes from the senses to the stars. So it's wow. like he's doing the whole visual space.
Right.
He knows about.
So he is not fragmented. He's an encyclopedist. He's from the rhetorical grammarian tradition. And he's up against the new dialectical tendencies of the printing press. Like, he doesn't foresee the disservices of the printing press, as far as you've read so far. Right?
Yes. But because he was saying it's not only the education of the mind, it's the education of perception and the recognition of God.
He had the right program.
Yeah.
He understood his understanding what the book would be, a new environment affecting perception. He had to be educated in that. He had it right. He wasn't hypnotized by dialectical speculation and concepts. But these environments are bigger than any individual thinker, so he couldn't stop the disservices. And in looking at his dates, he is basically the generation before Newton. He's 1592... let's see, 1592 to 1670. So he dies when Newton is 28. Do they talk about Comenius having any influence on Newton?
I suppose he was a big influence in all educated circles
right.
of his time.
So Comenius is part of the Francis Bacon era. And is it Erasmus? See, McLuhan makes Erasmus the guy using the new technology, using the printing press and creating a new kind of education. And Erasmus, well, he's a generation before, two generations before Comenius, but the printing press is nowhere in Erasmus's day. You know, it's not an environment. And you're saying it's not even really an environment in 1650, though McLuhan would say might be starting to be an environment. It's been around for 200 years. But education for kids was not an idea in people's minds until Comenius
yes,
came in.
Ioannis Comenius is the one that had the idea that anything, anytime, anywhere, for no reason at all, should be taught to all children, not only the aristocrats.
No matter what. Right. Okay, so you have our thesis that Zappa, started by you, that Zappa is a revolution in music as Bach was. And Bach comes a little after Comenius. Have you got any connection between Bach and Comenius?
Well, there was this idea that that the senses somehow perceive the harmony, the proportions, the balance. So, for him, the perception, that's another thing that I find similar to McLuhan, the senses. The sensus communis, that we should try to keep it in balance. It's like something composers try to do, to keep the proportions, to create beauty.
Right. That, so Bach is a next generation after Comenius, so he is dealing with the printing press as an environment. Its effects are starting to happen, and he wants to balance off the...
Yes, because in a way they thought there is the dialogue also between you and God.
Right.
And somehow to engage this conversation you have to seek this beauty, the balance, the perfection that we can see in how things work in nature, in harmony. And they saw it also, this harmony in the in the theory of the music of the spheres. That
okay,
yeah,
so.
he had to experience all this. The population of Europe was decimated after the religion wars. For example, here in Rixdorf, the king accepted the Bohemians escaping from what now we call the Czech Republic, because most people have died of the pest. So he gave two cows and land and a house to the people to repopulate Berlin, Rixdorf. And this situation was everywhere. A lot of people have died. A lot of people were starving. And actually, potatoes were a big thing in Europe then, because somehow the potatoes saved the poor population from starving.
Mm.
And he saw a lot of destruction and a lot of poverty and sickness. And he had these ideas that the only way to solve this situation was to have a sort of oleophatic education. And he talks about the importance of nutrition and education and perception and recognizing the divine. Like, don't forget the mystery landscape, because
right.
When people are only rational, it's like they have no boundaries to their violence, for example.
Yeah.
They don't believe that they're going to be punished or that there is heaven or hell or whatever. They can become like monsters and destroy. But he still had this very old ideas about God and religion. I mean, of course. But in a way, I like that he saw that the environment is what is educating you, and that you should yourself explore it, not only learn by memory.
Yeah, so because he was part of the ascendancy of the visual over the other senses, he was sort of like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, John Barlow and those guys that were determined to bring in the computer world and it would make information become free. He was an idealist of the printing press, but what's interesting, he comes from a tradition, it'd be interesting who his teachers were, of a comprehensive sensory harmony. And he understood that. And I don't think you get that from other schools of thinkers in his day. So so he's advocating a new novelty has come forth, and he says this can be used to free people in some way, enhance their sensory. And then you come to Zappa's world. That would be 300 years later. And I want to read you a description by a McLuhanite of 2015, 2016, and think back about what Comenius was up against. He had one new medium, and he was trying to get that to be an art form. And what would a guy like that think of today? So here is the description. This is in a book called McLuhan, subtitled Social Media Between Faith and Culture. And it was a conference on McLuhan's Catholic faith, the religious part of McLuhan, and they're trying to relate it to his sort of schizophrenic lifestyle, where he would be very involved with pagan culture, doing a lot in there, at the same time going to Mass every day. So these different professors try to reconcile their image of McLuhan. So this one guy, Paola Granata, he does an essay called A Return to Magic. But here's what he says. Recording technologies have also affected our approach to words. Now, words become a big deal in Comenius's day. You refine your word knowledge through the book. So he says, nowadays the ancient Latin motto, verba volant, scripta manent, seems to work in reverse. On Twitter, for example, scripta volant, written words fly away, while on YouTube, verba manent, spoken words remain. Mobile phones, tablets, and smartphones enable us to extend, to enhance the magic power of spoken words in order to replace the enchantment of an action, to grasp the moment when something happens. Our Facebook status sounds like a prayer. It is usually expressed as present tense verbs. Hashtags sound like incantations or new magic formulas. Flickr or Instagram provide ways to tell stories visually. Tweets seem to act as new spells. Twitting itself is a new form of storytelling. Story twitting, they call it, as I like to call it. The enchantment of words in the magic world of the media. So that's his introduction. Then he says, in light of all this, we can say that social media had placed the aesthetic experience within a flow, a multidimensional space of the happening, an event that today is mirrored by the different forms of online communication. Then he says, or communionion-cation. He takes the word communication, sticks O in, sticks ion in there. Communionion-cation, that Elena Lamberti came up with, that term. The aesthetic condition that can be experienced within this flow, where the sensorial, there's your senses, where the sensorial sphere is submitted to the live, real-time logic, is once again based on the concept of presence, or rather of co-presence, of the entire sensorial network. Experiencing one's aesthetics by acting within a flow, an event, or a happening, for example, by participating in the practices of sharing, typical of social media, or simply getting in the flow by sharing in others' activities, for example, by watching a live event or scanning the network for real-time personal public information, all that means giving a fully aesthetic meaning to the concept of performances of presence. He's going to make a big deal out of the word presence here. The performances of presence developed in this paper. What is the meaning, for example, of the widespread diffusion of increasingly sophisticated and miniaturized devices capable of storing, recording, and capturing live images, if not that of creating an heightened sense of presence? In this respect, it is interesting to note how in recent years the bloodiest events on the international scene, from the attack on the Twin Towers to the hanging of Saddam Hussein or the capture of Colonel Gaddafi, from the tsunami in southeastern Asia to the earthquake in Japan or the sinking of the Costa Concordia cruise ship in Italy, to name just a few, all these international bloody events have been projected as powerful media events precisely as evidence to be acquired live in both its visual and object dimensions that, although of often poor technical quality, is capable of generating a shattering emotional impact. Therefore, the term performance becomes both synonymous with identity presence, then he has the quote, I perform, therefore I am, as well as the result of the possibilities of extension and expansion of the sensorial powers currently offered by a multitude of devices. Equally, the perception of one's own presence is shaped, altered, massaged by the same possibilities that actually, in an almost Lacanian approach, take the form of a mirror that provides a confirmation of one's own identity presence. All in all, the performative character that is clearly inherent in the use of the social media may be considered as the reflection of an innate need to share collective forms of rituality that preserve their magic value in the contemporary age. Unlike the mass media that only allowed for a passive participation, the social media fully satisfy this need for rituality and ensure a form of active involvement in the modern ritual of communication. This is a need that is rooted in human nature and that technology, almost like religion, can catalyze precisely because it has a mysterious, sometimes obscure, amazing, all but magical power. McLuhan's magical mind insightfully saw all this. Therefore, read the essay in Mechanical Bride called The Magic That Changes Moods. The ad claims that the jukebox sounds... Okay, therefore, read today the ad claim The Magic That Changes Moods sounds as a serious warning. The new scene created by the social media celebrates nothing but a return to magic. A new technological spell leads us to live in an eternal present. A modern technological wizard, now wearing a mask that looks like a mobile device, that's like McLuhan's image of Lucifer, a modern technological wizard, now wearing a mask that looks like a mobile device, commands us to constantly leave traces of our presence in the present. To leave traces of our presence in the present. Perhaps it is no coincidence that this spell's magic formula is once more an ad claim that laconically states, quote, life is now, unquote. Now, I found this interesting because I've been explaining for the last 3 or 4 years that the social media are in a world where there's no sociality and no existence. So everybody is hyper-involved in saying there is a now and creating a now through all the different photographing, taping, and registering and archiving, so to prove that we still exist. And he's getting at that. He doesn't say it as simply as I do, but he's saying that presence is now a constant pressure on people to validate. So the next point is that this writer, Pio La Granata, was inspired by this. In 2005, he has a picture of the inauguration, or whatever they call it, of Pope St. Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, originally Cardinal Ratzinger. And all these Catholics are in the Vatican front yard, and they're all waiting or watching the Pope being made Pope. And it's 2005, and everybody's just looking forward at where they think the Pope is. So then Pio La Granata has a picture from 2013 when they bring in Pope Francis after Saint Pope Benedict. And it's 2013, the same scene of everybody milling around, hundreds of people waiting or watching. You can't see in the distance, but something, the inauguration of the Pope, whatever the actual term is. But the difference between 2005 and 2013 is that everybody is holding up a cell phone. Hundreds of people, each one of them is taking a recording of the beginning of the Pope Francis' reign. And it's like nobody trusts anybody else to have the image recorded. Everybody is in a panic of registering that there was a president, that there actually was a pope that did something. You get what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
So it's a really good picture, and millions of people. It's like in rock concerts, people holding up their lighter or smoking lighter, cigarette lighter. And there's a little flame. Well, there's hundreds of little flames, but they're actually the video screen of people recording this. Now,
you know, now, Bob.
You want to see this? Did you see that? Look at that. There's 2005 and there's 2013 in the same place.
Right. Well, now in rock concerts, they don't hold up their lighters. They hold up their cell phones with the either the light app or just the screen lit up.
They don't do the lighter anymore.
No.
You know, they probably faded that out a few years ago.
Yeah.
So that's what for the same function as the lighter.
Yeah.
For an encore or something. How do you know that? You've been there?
No.
You, is it a rumor or you pick it up by ESP? Like, you just know.
Ion told me.
Ion told you. Or maybe you've seen it on your TV shows.
Probably.
In Glee and that.
Yeah.
So now this registering of the present as an art form and as a validation and a panic. So it's panic registration of the present. I like to, let's see if we can relate that to what Frank's talking about. Because Frank started, let's say that Frank's a prophet of this condition, this ridiculous registering the present. So Frank starts off very young recording everything. So he knows he must record everything, tape recording everything. He's got archives back to when he was 15 years old. He's been taping things. And then he's telling kids when he first gets a chance to tell them in 65, 66, to say every 10 seconds, I doubt it. I doubt it.
Well,
remember we talked about that?
Like a sort of analogy, because people like Comenius thought the book was the